You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
I warn that there should be no place on Earth where terrorists can rest and train and practice their deadly skills. I meant it. I said that we would act with others if possible and alone if necessary to ensure that terrorists have no sanctuary anywhere.
World leaders make a point of telling us that they never negotiate with terrorists. We'll discuss whether that's always the best course of action. Also ahead.
I believe that it is the international community's first priority is to be able to end this conflict and then to use the momentum created by it to try to address all the other conflicts that are interlinked.
The UN's incoming Secretary General says that his top priority is to end Syria's war. But is the organisation doing enough to stop the violence there? And as xenophobia and post-truth enter our lexicon, we'll be asking our guests for the words that they think best characterise 2016. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Phil Clark, a reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, and we're also joined by Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome to you both. Now, let us begin with this question. Should governments negotiate with terrorists? There are reports from Nigeria that President Muhammadu Buhari is doing just that and is currently holding talks with Boko Haram in order to secure the release of girls who have been kidnapped by the group. Phil, perhaps before we get into that big question of should governments negotiate with terrorists, give us a bit of context to this story.
I guess the context is Boko Haram are obviously an armed group that have been wreaking havoc right across northern Nigeria and the wider region for the best part of 4 or 5 years. Part of their armed campaign was the kidnap of girls in places like Chibok and other villages. The Nigerian army have tried to tackle Boko Haram militarily and have failed miserably. And if anything, it's their failures have only increased and swelled the ranks of the rebel group, and now the Nigerian president is having to resort to sort of backdoor negotiations to get some of these kidnapped girls back and potentially try to find some peaceful solution to this conflict.
And does that strategy, Phil, have some level of support inside Nigeria?
It seems to, if only because the military response to Boko Haram has been such a failure. And we've seen large numbers of civilians killed by government forces, that the Nigerian military is completely corrupt and inept. And so I think, if nothing else, there seems to be a sense of desperation in northern Nigeria that a new tactic is required. And if this means the government actually speaking to the rebels and trying to negotiate on some sort of more peaceful terms, there does seem to be popular support for a new approach.
And Raffaello Pantucci, when we say negotiate, this isn't about the government asking nicely and a terrorist group saying, okay, fine. There has to be something given in return.
Well, I mean, clearly, if you're having a negotiation, you're negotiating for something. I think focusing on these particular girls it's kind of a bit of a lodestone, because this group got so much attention when these girls got kidnapped from Chibok in particular that, you know, they become kind of the thing that everyone's bartering for. I think the real dilemma for me is, who are they actually talking to? I mean, Boko Haram is an incredibly nebulous organization which doesn't really have any clear hierarchy. The leader has died, reappeared a number of times. There's been a number of people who've been suspected of being leader, who then has later been discovered were not. It's just very unclear organization. So the question for me in many ways is, who actually are they talking to? Do they really know if they're talking to the people who are holding these girls, or if they're talking to some section of the organization that's masquerading as something else, or who really knows? I'm actually not sure I totally agree with Phil's characterization of how things were going with the group at the moment. It's actually been in something of a retreat in Nigeria in particular for a bit of time now. Its problems have spread across the border, but actually we haven't seen the same level of kind of violence that you'd seen in previous years around the group in that. And in part, I think that is because Buhari has had a fairly good impact on the infamously, frankly, corrupt Nigerian army on actually getting them to reform a little bit and become a little bit more less sort of predatory themselves and a little bit more of an actual army trying to liberate some of the things. And so in some ways, I suspect this is kind of an adjunct to that policy, which is an attempt to try to improve the situation there and to try to actually have some sort of a negotiation strategy as well. Ultimately, if you want to deal with a problem like a terrorist group like this, which is born out of as much a sort of ethnic conflict in northeastern Nigeria as anything else, you are going to have to establish some sort of pathways of communication. And so it does make sense to be going down this. And if you're going to start those negotiations, starting around specific things like negotiating for the release of individuals gives you something to attach to hopefully then start something which maybe can be built up to at least create some sort of a peace with some of the factions within the group.
There are two separate things I want to get into here. First of all, Phil, when we're talking about negotiating the release of hostages, the climate we're in right now is very different from what it might have been 10 or 20 years ago, where hostages were taken for either for their monetary value or to make a political point. We're now in an era where hostages can sometimes be taken to be killed, and that is often the express purpose of why they've been taken. How does that change the dynamic for a government that is trying to get their citizens back?
In the case of a lot of terrorist groups, it means governments have to be doubly careful because if they rile a terrorist group that has those kinds of intentions, that then they can see kidnapped civilians killed very quickly and often killed in very high profile social media shown around the world kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. But I think in the Boko Haram case, the kidnap of the Chibok girls was primarily for propaganda purposes, and Boko Haram has one of the most sophisticated YouTube communication channels of any terrorist group in the last 10 years or so, and they paraded the Chibok girls in a very public way, and have given sort of fairly regular updates with the Chibok girls featured very prominently in the background. This is Boko Haram firstly trying to show how powerful it is and trying to make a mockery of the Nigerian state, and also it's a statement to the wider region that Boko Haram now considers itself a regional actor with these bases across the border in Niger and Cameroon. It's kind of capturing of territory around Lake Chad. Sort of parading these girls is a way of sort of displaying the might and the sophistication of the organization. And that makes the Nigerian government's task in negotiating with Boko Haram around the release of these girls extremely delicate, because it's about trying to remove from Boko Haram one of its main propaganda tools.
And of course, Raffaello, we end up helping this propaganda move. We've been discussing Boko Haram here for 8 minutes. We're going to talk about them for a bit longer. Mm-hmm. If they were just a group in northern Nigeria who were campaigning against, as they saw it, Western education and all the ills that it had brought to northern Nigeria, as they had originally said their aims were, mm-hmm. We wouldn't be mentioning them at all, would we?
Well, I mean, look, any terrorist organization has a message it's trying to get across, and they use whatever means are at their disposal to do that. If it's kidnapping people and then parading them on television and executing them, if it's about getting money, if it's about doing terrorist atrocities in cities in the West or elsewhere or against Westerners, it's about attracting attention to their message to get their message broadcast more loudly. So that's what terrorist groups do. The difficulty, I think, is for, in some ways, the media and the sort of public discourse around it is, well, what do you do? Do you ignore that? In which case, you end up maybe suppressing information and hiding stories and realities that are happening out there. Or do you broadcast it? In which case, you're potentially giving fuel to the very, you're giving oxygen to the very fire that they're trying to sort of stoke. And I think you just have to tread a very delicate and difficult line in between. We saw recently in the French press, there was a decision that was made by some of the mainstream people, Le Monde and others, to not publicize the names or images of terrorists in France. So they just sort of refused to now publish their names and information in the papers. Now, I think we've kind of moved on from everyone getting their information in France from Le Monde. So quite frankly, in some ways, that ship
is more symbolic than anything else.
It's more symbolic for the newspaper and their sense of who they are and what their role is. But it does speak to a bigger dilemma, which I think is, on the one hand, if you hide all the information, then it's censorship and that raises questions about what kind of a society we are. Whereas on the other hand, if you broadcast too much, you're kind of doing their job for them. And I think what you often see is the media tends to find a point of calibration after a period of time. You know, and the Jihadi John videos are the famous instance of that.
And Raffaella, just to look at, you mentioned ISIS there. There was a decision taken when ISIS began kidnapping or buying hostages from other groups, Western hostages, particularly journalists. There was a decision made by the families and the countries involved not to initially publicise those kidnappings. And actually the first that most people heard about them was when ISIS then publicised the killings. What do you think has been learnt from that process? Because I know that, for example, a lot of the families involved were sceptical about whether that was a good strategy or not.
Well, it's a classic negotiation strategy, because if you start broadcasting that this person is being held by the group, the danger is that then you're closing down an avenue for the group to walk away from this incident peacefully. So if the world knows that this organization is holding this individual and this is some sort of ideologically driven group, and then lo and behold, this person gets released and everyone knows that he was released for money, then suddenly they look more like a criminal organization than an ideological terrorist one. And so the idea of suppressing the information is that you close that option down. So you basically mean that there is no kind of discussion about it. So the group, if they want, can be negotiated with to release the person and kind of move on, and everyone pretends nothing really happened. The difficulty with that is you also put a lot of cards in the hand of the terrorists and the people who are negotiating, because they basically have all the power. They can do what they want. They can manipulate the situation in any way they want, and you kind of are powerless to do anything except adhere to their demands and pay the cost. I think the lesson that has been learned from that is a very difficult one, because as we saw in that particular incident, governments that negotiated and were willing to ultimately pay, frankly, saw their citizens get released, and countries that didn't, did not.
I think the only thing I would kind of add to this is negotiations aren't just about doing deals over hostages and that kind of thing. I mean, one of the things that's sort of interesting to me is if you go back through the list of major terrorist groups over the last 10 or 20 years that we have been told governments should never negotiate with. Mm. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was the IRA here in the British situation. Mm. For the last 30 plus years in Colombia, it's been never negotiate with the FARC. After the 9/11 attacks, we heard, you know, governments should never negotiate with the Taliban. Well, actually, very important peace talks, very important negotiations have taken place with all of those armed actors. It's almost as though whoever the current, you know, kind of evil is in the world, we designate as beyond negotiation. But give it kind of 5-10 years, we may in fact find governments negotiating with the likes of ISIS. And it would have been, I think, a frightening situation if we had thought that there were only military solutions to dealing with the IRA situation, or dealing with the FARC, or even more recently dealing with the Taliban.
I mean, I was just going to say it's a very important point you make. And I think the question becomes, what do you negotiate about? You know, so I think the question is, can you negotiate about individual cases? So can you negotiate, you're holding this individual, so we'll talk to you to try to get that person freed. But is that the same about negotiating about the bigger goal? You know, can we negotiate with ISIS to say, yes, the whole world should be turned over to Allah's sort of greater power? Well, no, but can we negotiate with them to get this individual released? The difficulty is you're kind of recognizing the group then at the same time. And so from a government perspective, it's like, are you elevating an organization into something? And then where might that end up leading to?
I just want to go back to then the Nigerian situation, Phil, because is there an argument that actually now that Nigeria has, you know, Nigeria, as long as it's been a democracy, has switched between having a Muslim president and then a Christian president, someone from the north and someone from the south. Mm. And there had been a gentleman's agreement that was how things worked. That broke down after President Yar'Adua passed away while in office and Goodluck Jonathan took his place, a southerner, a Christian, and then ran for office himself. Now that there is a Muslim president again in Buhari, are there things that he can do to, I don't want to use the phrase drain the swamp, but to bring some people in the north who might have been swayed by Boko Haram's more general arguments about the state of Nigeria back into the tent?
I think the biggest issue there is socioeconomic development in the north. I think that is the biggest challenge here. It's not about a military solution against Boko Haram. That's been tried. That has failed. The key here, I think, is to remove the fundamental basis on which thousands, particularly of young northern Nigerian men, have joined Boko Haram and swelled their ranks. And that is a sense of fundamental socioeconomic marginalization, of living on the fringes, of never fully being part of society. And that would require Buhari to do something that really no Nigerian government has been able to do for as long as anyone can remember, which is genuinely spread the development that the south of Nigeria has enjoyed to the north. And that, I think, would really take the sting out of Boko Haram's message.
Rafaela, looking at the situation with ISIS, and, you know, as Phil's saying, we've looked at groups in the past that they said, well, we'll never negotiate with them, we'll never negotiate with them, and then we end up negotiating with them. Is the issue actually with ISIS not whether the West negotiates with ISIS, but whether, you know, the government in Iraq negotiates with ISIS, the government in Syria, whatever government emerges in the coming years, negotiates with ISIS, that these are local and regional issues that need to be worked out, and that's where the peace deals, if any, need to happen?
I mean, the difficulty is that, again, I think if you're talking to the sort of ISIS leadership, there really isn't much of a negotiation to be had, quite frankly, except if you're talking a very tactical question about this prisoner for this amount of money. I think because when you're talking about it, their vision, their outlook, what they think they're doing and what they think they're winning is a war very much driven by God's greater message to create, recreate this entire region into God's greater glory. It's not a question of, you know, some sort of partial negotiation that can be achieved within that context. Where I think you can have some success in negotiation, and I think this is probably where I would imagine that Iraqi government, at least the Syrian government, it's difficult to tell, is focusing some of its attention, is, well, are there some tribes in the Sunni parts of Iraq who are willing to sort of blend their forces and their fight and their might to the sort of ISIS message, because, or the ISIS banner more appropriately, because they were so angry at the sort of Shia government that was coming out of Baghdad, which was pushing a very sectarian message. And now they see that the new government is actually trying something new, and actually they can buy into that and they can sort of support them. So with those people, you can have a negotiation, you can sort of peel away some of these parts. But I think when you're talking about the core of these groups, you're talking about groups that have a very clear ideological vision that is in a very different direction to the sort of Westphalian model that we might sort of conceptualize. It's not, in some ways, you know, I'm very much aware of Phil's point, and I kind of very agree with it, that we always find this is the most terrible, we can't negotiate with this. But there is a difference between the IRA, who at least have a sort of a territorial concept that we can kind of comprehend and negotiate with, than an organization like ISIS, which is really driven in a very different direction and pushing a very different kind of ideology that is kind of beyond our Westphalian negotiating capacity. And then the other point is who are you going to negotiate with those people? What about the people who live in those territories? You know, what stake do they have in this? Do they really want to live under this? I mean, I'm not so sure anyone wants to live under an ISIS state, except some of these foreign fighters we see are really being motivated to go over there.
And just finally, Phil, on that point that Rafael just raised there about who you're negotiating with, we see this again and again, whether it's in Colombia, whether it's in Darfur, and whether it's with the Taliban in Afghanistan. It's the people with guns that meet around the table and that there are negotiations with. And there will be lip service played to, well, civil society will be involved, there'll be some women's groups, there'll be some local groups that will be involved. But actually, when it comes down to it, it's the people with guns. And again, to go back to where we began on this, whereby, you know, our actions end up leading to more hostages being taken. Are we not, by only dealing with the people with guns, encouraging people to take up guns?
There's the potential for that. It's difficult to deny that. But I think, you know, one other way to get around this is also to go beyond the idea that we're only having to negotiate with the so-called leadership of any of these groups. And I think there is also something to be said, you know, I think Raffaello was beginning to kind of allude to this, as some of the groups that support terrorist groups, also talking to them, but also talking to the more peripheral actors within these terrorist organizations. They're often very large. They often involve all sorts of different groups that have been cobbled together into a movement that we call Boko Haram, that we call ISIS. There's also the scope there to talk to those on the fringes. And if you can convince them to lay down their arms, then you start to affect the central ideology and the central action of those groups. So it's not only, I think, about talking to those we consider to be at the top.
Okay, I want to move on, and since we're in the Middle East, we'll stay there. The United Nations has said that around 16,000 people have been displaced since the Syrian government's advance into rebel-held areas of Aleppo. It's prompted France to call for an immediate UN Security Council meeting to discuss the situation. But, Raffaello Pantucci, what can the Security Council actually do to stop the violence, given that one of its members, namely Russia, is involved?
I mean, very little, quite frankly. I think if there was something that could be done, it would have been done by now. People have been shouting to try to get, get some sort of cessation of violence for some time. And it's just abundantly clear that it's not happening. Russia is, I think the Russians and the Assad regime have concluded that now is a moment that they can push very hard to try to bring this to the conclusion that they want, which is essentially the eradication of the groups that are holding parts of Aleppo, take Aleppo back. And once that happens, you're really going to start to talk about the end of the sort of insurgency in Syria in many ways. They will continue to exist. They'll continue to operate in some parts of the country, but the sort of loss of Aleppo would be a major strategic blow to them. And I think from the Russians' perspective, just keep on pushing because no one's really going to actually stand up and stop you.
And no one's going to stand up and stop them, Phil, because President Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry might have tried in their own ways to do certain things, but you suspected that certainly on Obama's side, his heart wasn't necessarily in it. And now, in 2 months' time, he's going to be replaced by a man who sees ISIS alone as the enemy and is very happy to side with Russia.
Indeed. Difficult to argue against that analysis. I mean, one of the difficulties for Obama was clearly he could never put US ground troops into Syria to really systematically try and deal with the situation. In doing that, he basically ceded enormous amounts of influence to the Assad government and then latterly backed by Russia. The situation, I think, at the moment is, I mean, Trump, this is one of the few foreign policy issues he has been very clear on, sees Russia as the fundamental solution to what's happening in Syria. He's totally okay with the alliance between Assad and Russia in targeting ISIS. And the natural conclusion from all of that is that the US will stop backing any of the Syrian rebel groups. They will effectively sacrifice the civilian population in East Aleppo for the sake of being able to target ISIS. Given that political scenario, it's very difficult to conclude anything other than there's going to be a civilian bloodbath. And at the same time, I also suspect that Russia and Assad will basically fail to militarily target ISIS. I'm not sure that it's the kind of fighting force that their form of aerial bombardment is really equipped to tackle with. So not only will they lose their military victory against ISIS, we're going to see a massive civilian death toll, unfortunately.
And Raffaello, those last remaining rebels, those that had been termed moderate by some, that had some limited support from the West, they won't just quietly pack up and go if, you know, they feel that the people that back them aren't with them anymore. They'll look for funding elsewhere.
Well, I mean, I think you're going to continue to see some sort of support happening for the sort of moderate rebels. But frankly, you know, what you're seeing in a lot of these groups is they are getting subsumed by groups like Jaish Fath al-Sham, which is, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is essentially al-Qaeda on the battlefield, or Ahrar al-Sham, which is a very Salafi jihadi group that's fighting on the battlefield. And you're slowly seeing them becoming the sort of dominant feature. And you're seeing them becoming the sort of principal actors. And they have support bases abroad. They have support networks who are providing them with equipment and funding. They will continue to receive that. And they will continue to take the struggle up with the Assad regime. But I think that if you see a loss of Aleppo, it is a kind of strategic symbol. And the thing about these groups is that they can go and rattle their tin cups to raise money from various sources. But ultimately, those sources want to be supporting a group that they can see which is winning and succeeding. And if it's really not, you're going to start to see some question into whether that support will continue to flow to them or will find other places to support.
Phil, I mean, we've talked about Syria, you know, almost every day for the past 5 years or so, and this is happening, and Aleppo's going to be destroyed. It's going to be a humanitarian catastrophe, and everyone's just standing around and saying, well, this is going to happen, and no one can stop it. It's not obviously an easy situation to stop. This isn't like, you know, when people say, well, we've said never again before, you know, this isn't like Rwanda in 1994, where actually it would not have taken very much at all for that to be stopped. But what does this tell us about the world and how much we care about our neighbours?
it tells us a great deal about power within the Security Council. And I think what it says is, as soon as you have a state like Assad's regime in Syria being backed by one of the permanent members of the Security Council, there is no effective UN role in these kinds of conflict. And the only long-term solution there is fundamental reform of the Security Council, but that's not on the horizon anytime soon. So I actually think this is a really sobering moment in what we think needs to be done in these kind of conflict zones and how much faith we continue to place in international bodies like the UN. Power rules, unfortunately. And I think the sooner we come to terms with that, the better, because this is going to need a whole lot more creative thinking. And it's got to go beyond just sort of hoping that the UN is going to be a savior in these kinds of situations.
I mean, the precedent I say is look at Bosnia. You know, you think about Bosnia in the 90s, exactly the same sort of thing. We sort of stood by and watched. And then eventually the West did move in. We did see some major bombing. You did see the Serbian forces getting pushed out, but you just don't see how that's going to happen in this particular context. And I think it's just, you know, the unintended consequences of this are going to be impossible to predict sitting here and now. I could say, looking at the process of radicalization and people being drawn towards jihadist ideas, this gives them a picture postcard case study of how little the West cares about Muslims dying. So what the ramifications of that will be, what the ramifications of Russian power will be, what the ramifications of the Syrian regime reestablishing itself and its relations with Turkey and Iran. I think there's a whole set of questions here that are just impossible to predict how they will play out, but will undoubtedly have an impact on our world for the next 10 years.
Okay. 2 months now until Donald Trump is inaugurated as the president of the United States. He's already starting to shape global events. It's been called the Trump effect, but how does that manifest itself? Phil Clark, obviously, in one way, as we were just discussing with Syria, it's had an impact there. But how else do you see the Trump effect taking place?
I think for me, I've always thought this was one of the scariest things about Trump. What wasn't even what he could do directly in terms of his own policy making, it was the way that it was going to embolden a whole lot of other actors around the world who would sort of respond to the idea of a Trump presidency. And I think you can already see this all over the globe. You can see it in the form of right-wing parties in Israel agitating for the expansion of Jewish settlements, wanting to capture control of the situation, you know, so that's the kind of situation that Trump has to deal with when he comes to power. Of course, you can see it in Syria. There's no coincidence that Syria and Russia have ramped up their violence in East Aleppo, in the knowledge that Obama is completely distracted and doesn't have much time left. And again, they want to, you know, control the situation before Trump comes to power. And those are just two examples, you know, of states that are trying to capitalize on what they think a Trump presidency is going to be about.
And Raffaello, we're also going to see it in the coming months and years in China, because particularly with the ending, supposedly, of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal that America had struck with 11, 12 other nations within the Pacific region that Trump says he's not going to sign, China is looking at that situation and thinking, okay, this works for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, one of the most interesting sort of details of that week when you had the election in the United States was at the same time you had this election happening, Premier Li Keqiang of China went on a kind of road trip along the Silk Roads going through Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Latvia and Russia, right? Kind of trailing the Silk Roads in that direction, which is kind of the big narrative coming out of China at the moment, which is connectivity. You know, it's reconnect China on this Belt and Road Initiative. And when you think about that from a sort of vision perspective and you compare that to an America which is talking about cutting trade deals, which is about being more isolationist, which is talking about returning America to some sort of greatness that it's been missing, and you know, I don't think it actually is, quite frankly, but you know, this sort of sense of an isolationist nativist country, when you're looking at a China which is the ultimate sort of, you know, paranoid communist power in many ways, but it's talking this narrative of connectivity around the world and is getting a lot of bounce out of it, it's just a really fascinating sort of switch of events.
And Phil, of course, if, you know, one major power steps back, there is a vacuum that can then be filled.
Indeed, and China and Russia have been on a footing for that kind of thing for a long time, and Trump, I think, has just energized that. I think one of the other manifestations of the Trump effect is the boost that it's given to right-wing political parties in numerous parts of the world. Across Europe, we can see it in particularly in France and Germany in the lead-up to their elections, how much these right-wing parties have been emboldened by what's been happening in the US. Here in the UK, again, you know, you only had to watch the leadership election in UKIP yesterday. Again, so many references being made to Trump and needing to tap into the disaffected working class and all the rest of it. So the rise of right-wing populism, I think, is another manifestation of this Trump effect.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Phil Clark, Raffaello Pantucci, thank you very much indeed. We were going to talk about words. We'll talk about that tomorrow. That was Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gal Bunier. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.